and welcome to today's open mic call. Today's topic is CICS Web Services. My name is Elijah Robertson, and today's call will allow you to speak with our panel of experts available to us today on today's call. We'll be able to speak with them about our CICS Web Service questions. You may also access the presentation by going to IBM.com and typing the tech doc number 701-3267 in the search box found at the very top right of the page. Also, I did want to let everyone know we had an overwhelming response to today's open mic with submitted questions. So we weren't able to include everyone's questions, but they will be addressed either with another open mic or by email. Before we begin with our questions and answers, we'll start with a technical overview of CICS Web Services. But first, I would like to introduce our panel of experts. On our panel, we have Paul Cooper, Mark Pocock, Charlie White, Steve Webb, Lee Compton, Dennis Winant, and Fraser Baum. First, we'd like to go to Paul Cooper.
Hello, everybody. I'm Paul. I'm a member of the KIC Development Organization in Hersey here in the UK. I've been working with KIC Web Services since it first came out in TS3.1, and I have a personal responsibility for the data mapping part of the KIC Web Services. So this is the Web Services Assistant, and it's the runtime transformation engine. So I'll be talking more about that later.
Okay. And we'll go to Mark Pocock.
Hi everyone, I'm Mark Pocock. I'm a member of the KIC Level 3 service team, and it's the change team. I've been there for the last 11 years, working on mostly web technologies, so the web interface when it was first introduced, evolution into KIC's web support, niche of KIC's web services, the bridge, sockets domain, and all the other technologies associated with that.
And to Charlie White.
Work with the CICS Level 2 support team in Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Been working with CICS for over 20 years for various customers. For the last 5 years for IBM at Level 2 support, and have been involved in the web services work since it was released in CICS 3.1.
And we'll go to Stephen Webb.
Stephen Webb, I have 19 years with Level 2, the last 10 with CICS. I'm now a knowledge engineer for KIC, publishing content for the KIC support pages.
And over to Lee Compton.
Hi, this is Lee Compton. I do technical support for CICS for both customers and our IBM sales force, and I work out of the Dallas Systems Center.
And next to Dennis Wyatt.
Hi, I also work with Lee in the Dallas Systems Center, and I primarily work with CICS's web services support, also Java support, and the CICS Transaction Gateway.
Next, we'll go to Fraser Baum.
Hi there. I'm a member of the KIC development team based in the Hersey Lab, along with Paul. I'm the technical lead for web services in KIC, so I've worked on web services in KIC since we did the SOAP for KIC support pack. So I have overall architectural and design responsibility.
And finally, we have Gary Mazzo.
Hi, my name is Gary Mazzo, and I work with Ration Developer for System Z. It's a product in support of developing applications on System Z, and including the web services. Also responsible for developing tools enabling the applications to be web services in KIC. Have been working with KIC for the last several years, and I'm based in Santa Teresa, California.
We would like to thank our panel for joining today, and we'll begin with questions and answers following this technical overview of CICS Web Services from Fraser Baum.
Right, so we're just going to do a very quick overview before we get on to the questions. First of all, a little bit of history. We started this support in KIC TF version 2 with a SOAP for KIC support pack, which started off as an unsupported support pack and then evolved into a supported support pack and then an optional supported feature before actually productizing the support in KIC TF 3.1. continued to enhance that support since. Along with that, both Rational and other business partners have built tools around this support. Kix provides essentially web services support as both a web services provider, where Kix hosts the service, and as a requester, where Kix calls out to a service. So it's bidirectional. And the main focus has been around both providing protocol level support for things like SOAP and the various WS specifications like security and atomic transactions, as well as WSDL focused and schema focused support for creating data bindings between XML representations and traditional COBOL PL1 C etc. Bindings to applications, so creating existing COM areas or exploiting the new channel and container support in Kix TS version 3. We make quite a clear distinction between those two layers, and I think that will come up in some of the questions, and we try and make both sides of that extensible. So the pipeline that handles protocol level things can be extended by user handlers to control protocol level issues, and the data mapping portion can be extended or replaced. So you can either use ours or use one of the vendor ones. As we've gone through, we've made a particular effort to continue expanding both the WS star set that we support and the number of different mapping types that we support. We see three main patterns there, and again, that might come up later. The first one is obviously the one people most often start with, where you take an existing COM area application that sits in Kix and try and enable that as a web service. That's the kind of bottom-up pattern. More often as a requester, you're given a WSDL document, and then we see the top-down pattern being used, which can also be used in the provider, where you use the WSDL to generate data bindings that you then implement with a new Kix asset or application. And there's a meet-in-the-middle approach where you do a sort of half-and-half thing. And we consider all three of those valuable patterns for us to support. So that was a whirlwind overview of what's in Kix Web Services support.
All right. Thank you, Fraser, for that introduction. We'll begin with our question and answers. But first, we would like to start out by answering our submitted questions that were submitted early before today's open mic to our panel. So I would like to turn the call over to Lee Compton.
Thank you, Elijah. We're going to go through the questions that were submitted via email, and then we'll have the we'll allow you to ask questions from the floor when we've gotten through those. Our first question is, how do I get started with web services and CICS? And we've asked Charlie Wheezy to address this one.
Thanks, Lee. We get that question quite often, actually, with level 2 support. And I know it's really tempting for people. They really just want to jump into it. But we've really truly found that the best way, the shortest and most consistent path to implementing web services in their shop is to use the catalog manager example application that's described in the CICS Web Services Guide. It's the last chapter in the Web Services Guide. You'll find it in Chapter 16 of the 3.1 manual, Chapter 14 of the 3.2 manual. Now, once you have that, or on the way to getting that example application installed and working, we also recommend referring to some of our materials that can help educate you on that process and on what you're doing with web services. In the Information Center, the CICS Transaction Server Information Center, you'll find some information roadmaps on web services that have a number of links to educate you on web services processing, not only from a CICS standpoint, but really from an industry standpoint as well. I'd also like to recommend a different Web Services Technical Exchange presentation that I made back in June, where we talked about Kix Web Services problems and pitfalls, that it also included some good orientation and kind of introductory information. A couple other references for you. There's an excellent article in our TechNote database that describes testing web services with Eclipse, and there's actually a reference to that note up on the slide for you. There's also a reference to the red paper that we worked on recently. It talked about some performance characteristics of SOAP message sizes, but it also, and more importantly, I think, described not an example app, really, but a real-life application using Dendonska Bank and their ATM applications that really demonstrates web services functioning and what they did to implement their web services in within their shop.
Okay, thank you, Charlie. Our second question is going to be answered by Fraser Baum in Hursley, and the question is, what is the difference between CICS Web Services, CICS Web Support, and the KICS Web Interface?
Right, so I have the benefit of having worked on all those items. So essentially, we'll start with KICS Web Support and KICS and the KICS Web Interface, as they are effectively synonymous. KICS Web Support and the Web Interface are focused around providing HTTP capability to KICS. So that is focused on either, as of KICS TS 3.2, KICS acting as a HTTP client, or prior to that, as an HTTP server. And the APIs then are focused around serving up HTML or HTTP responses to requests, or actually making those requests. So the most common use there, as I said, is to serve dynamic HTML back out as the result of requests coming in. Now, one reason why this is sometimes confused with web services is that it is entirely possible, and KICS itself does it, to flow SOAP XML over the HTTP protocol. And when we do that, we make use of the KICS web support to do so, although that is actually exploiting the KICS web services. So web support is about HTTP. The web services support is about SOAP and XML. SOAP and XML can come into KICS or out of KICS over HTTP using the web support, but it could also flow over WebSphere MQ as well, in which case there's no KICS web support involved at all. The other main difference between the two things is one of focus, although with things like RESTful SOA and the Atom support pack, those lines are a bit blurred. But one easy way to think of it is web services is usually mainly focused on program-to-program communication with a very formal contract, often described in WSDL and schema. And web support is much more often focused at end-user interaction in a browser, so serving up HTML, JavaScript, things like that.
Thank you. And since you did such a good job on that question, we're going to ask Fraser to answer the next one. I've been researching on how to set up web services. From a practical point of view, is it better to set up a new KICS region that does all of the initial web services routing versus installing web services in a series of AORs?
Right. So, both of those patterns are supported. You can do either. But from a best practice point of view, I would suggest the former, where you have separate regions that act in much in the way that TORs acted in the past for terminals, that receive the web services requests, run the pipelines, and if you're using our supplied application handler, so our web services support in its entirety, then do a DPL out of that to the AOR that owns the application. There's a number of reasons why that's a good idea. Workload management is much simpler to achieve in that setup, and you only need the web services artifacts in the receiving regions, not in the AORs. And then that does allow you to have, for example, if a new set of function arrives in 3.2 and you've got AORs at 3.1 to just upgrade the web services receiving regions initially to 3.2 without needing to change the AORs. We've also seen a similar approach used for outbound web services, where an AOR does a DPL to a region which is kind of synonymous to a file-owning region, which has a stub program in it which actually makes the exec KICS invoke web service call. And that can allow you to get the same sort of workload management behavior and region separation for outbound web services as well as this case, which was about KICS as a provider.
Okay. Thank you very much, Fraser. We're going to ask Paul Cooper to address the next question. Is there any detailed documentation for .NET or Visual Studio integration?
Okay. Well, the quick answer is unfortunately quite short, and that's fact, no, there isn't. We don't have any detailed documentation for using Kix Web Services with products from any particular vendor. We do have a little bit of information about using web services with Eclipse, which I'll talk about a little bit more in the next question. However, the thing with web services is that you have this document, this WSDL, or WSDL document, which describes the contract, if you like, shared between the two or more participants in the web service. And that contract, as expressed in WSDL, is vendor neutral. And so, in theory, you should be able to import that into your favourite development environment from your favourite vendor and just use it as applied. Now, I can't comment on how .NET Visual Studio works because I've never used it. But I would hope that if you go and talk to the vendors, presumably Microsoft in that case, that they'll be able to talk you through how to use WSDL to connect to a remote service. I'm sorry, the answer is no, I don't have any detailed documentation for that.
And the related question was that the customer submitted this question, says, the WSDL we generated for a simple program was pulled into Visual Studio, but it offered no sample test application the way WSDLs we generate through Visual Studio do. Yet, when we pulled the same WSDL into Eclipse, the sample application was offered right away. And their question is, does IBM plan tighter integration with Visual Studio?
So this is kind of part of the same general question. And the answer is, it's still no, but the WSDL should, because it's vendor neutral by definition, any vendor who chooses to support WSDL, you would hope that their development environment would work with WSDL from other vendors. Now, the link I supplied at the bottom of the slide for question 5 does actually point to a tech note that we put out for testing Kix Web Services with the Eclipse development environment. Eclipse is a free software product we use quite a lot internally for our own testing, and it has some nice capabilities. And if you go off and follow that link, it will talk you through how you can use Eclipse to test web services, whether they're hosting Kix or hosted anywhere else. And the kind of techniques involved with doing that are the kind of things that other vendors may have implemented in their products. But again, I can't comment on what other folks have done.
Okay, thank you, Paul. Let's move on to the next question, question number 6. What's the easiest way to debug my web services application? We're going to ask Steve Webb to address that one.
The answer to this really depends on where the problem is occurring within the web service. Your web service request is processing in Kix, meaning the request was made it into Kix, or you're sending an outbound request from Kix. You can use Kix Auth Trace or internal trace with a system dump to look at the trace flow, just like you would any other Kix component. We would recommend that the trace be at least 10 megs where possible, and have level 1-2 tracing on for the PI, WB, and SO components, all for the PG component for Transaction Server 3.1, and PG 1-2 for Transaction Server 3.2, and all other components set to 1. There's a reference on this page to must-gather documentation, which has the details for gathering documentation for a web service. You can also use CEDX, which is a non-terminal form of CEDF, to step through the exec Kix command in your application. It's often helpful to use CEDX with the CPIH transaction to see the flow. CPIH is the default alias for pipeline and web service processing. And if you're using or having a problem with the actual web services assistant, CFHWS to LS or LS to WS, you can examine the error log specified in the log file parameter, and you can also run your WSDL through a validation tool such as RDB or Eclipse. You could also turn on validation for the web service to get additional diagnostic information on the SOAP message that's either arriving or being sent out, and you would check the system log for the output on that. Another source of debugging information is to take a look at any false information that you might be receiving in the application. And from a service perspective, we would recommend that you're at a good or the highest maintenance level and to use the highest mapping level available for your release if possible. And two other references are the knowledge collection for web services, which has been recently updated, and also to search the KIX transaction server support site, which is also listed there as a reference, to find if there are any known problems that might match your symptoms.
Thank you, Steve. Related to that question, we have a question that says, how do I diagnose a CICS web services conversion error? We're going to ask Paul Cooper to talk about that.
Okay. So first of all, let's just mention what a conversion error is. So this is the kind of problem you get when conversing between application data and XML. And so it may be a SOAP message has been sent into KIX, and for whatever reason, KIX is unable to convert that into application data, maybe because something invalid in the XML was sent in. Or it might be on the return leg, where a response constructed by the KIX application program, for whatever reason, cannot be converted back into XML. Or indeed, in the requester scenario, you might have an application hosted in KIX, which is trying to make a remote connection to something out on the network. And again, either of those problems can occur with creating the request or receiving the response. Now, there's many different layers in the KIX web services supported, and you know, problems can occur in any of them. So by conversion error, I'm specifically referring to that layer of code which is doing those data conversions. Yeah, if a problem occurs in, for example, the transport layer of code or in the SOAP parsing layer of code, that's a slightly different bit of KIX and the technique you've used is slightly different. And indeed, you know, diagnosing problems is a fairly rich subject in its own right. I'm sure we could have an entire session like this one just talking about that particular subject. However, the general technique that you want to use is, first of all, to take a look in the KIX message log. Because in most cases, there'll be some kind of DFHPI message, right? There's a number of different messages that may get issued. That message is the first place to start. In most cases, it will identify the name of an XML tag that the problem's associated with, and a clue as to what kind of problems occurred. It may be an overflow condition of some kind. For example, if the data that's been sent into KIX is too large to squeeze into this field that's been allocated in the COBOL language structure, it could be some kind of range error. For example, if the field is defined as only allowing positive values, yet a negative value is what arrives on the wire, then again we would have trouble converting that value. So there's a whole range of different types of errors, and the DHPI message is the place to start. Now, each of those messages has associated with it an explanation, which you can see if you look the message up in the information center or using the CMAC transaction. And that explanation does attempt to tell you the next step to take in the diagnosis process. And one technique that it suggests, which is a very useful one, is to use something called runtime validation, which is a capability you can turn on or off for a particular web service. And what that does for you is it causes KIX at runtime to link to a separate program which will do a full and rigorous validation of the SOAP messages of the XML. And what that does is it compares the actual data that's flowing on the wire to the original schema definition, which came from the WSDL, the WSDL document that's associated with the web service. And the kind of things that can check is a lot broader than the kind of things that the base KIX technology can detect. So it will detect all sorts of problems that might otherwise go unnoticed. So enabling runtime validation is a very good idea, but the cost with that, of course, is that it is very slow. It involves linking to a Java program and involves quite a lot of heavy-duty processing. So it's not the kind of thing you'd normally want to have turned on in a production environment. But I very strongly recommend using it during application development. It's a very good way of finding problems. And the messages that you get out from that tend to be a lot more detailed than the messages that you would get otherwise. So start with the DHPI message. then use runtime validation. Another thing that you can use if you're feeling brave is to take a look at the Kix trace, the PI trace, because whenever a conversion error occurs, an exception trace point will be issued. And that exception trace point has in it the same kind of information that appears in the message, but with one useful addition, and that is that it shows you some of the associated data. So up to 4K worth of data, which is hardly much to squeeze into a message. Messages don't allow you to have those large inserts. So if you do take a look in the exception trace for some Kix, then you should see a little bit more information to help you get context as to where the problem is and what kind of error is being seen. So those are the main techniques. There's a couple of useful tech notes that I point you to, one which talks about conversion errors generally, and another which talks about the kind of problems that can occur in the SOAP layer of processing, where we have a PL1 XML parser which can also detect certain problems, and the diagnostic issues are slightly different. So the two references I've got there, I'd recommend you go off and take a look at them. Most of that information is in the information center in various different places, but it pulls together quite nicely in the tech notes.
That was actually complete. Thank you, Paul. I'm going to put you on the spot again, though. We have a question that asks, is there any way for my application to participate in the troubleshooting for a web services error?
Okay, so participating. Again, the short answer is no, not really, but there is a longer answer. The ethos in Kix, the idea is that we make sure that we don't lose data. So if a certain message comes into Kix which contains something which Kix can't convert into application data, we don't attempt a best fit. You know, we don't, for example, truncate fields or round values. If the information cannot be converted to application data, then Kix rejects it and sends back a fault message to whoever sent the data in, and consequently everything is, you know, is backed out and rolled back. So that's by design, that's by intent. And in that scenario, where there's a problem with information sent into Kix, then the problem's occurred before the application program has even been invoked. Now, there's another category of error, of course, which happens on the response, where for some reason the application's produced something that can't be converted back into XML. But again, this is after the application has finished, so again, we can't really prod the application to do something about it. So under normal circumstances, there really isn't a way for the application itself to participate in those mapping decisions. There's ever so slightly more opportunity with the Invoke Web Service API, because at least the application is programmatically involved with the interactions with Kix. So when the exec Kix Invoke Web Service API returns back to the application could choose to go and have a look through various containers that exist on the channel and attempt to generate some useful information from that. But in general, we find that the only useful piece of information is, did a fault come back, or did the expected response come back? One scenario which is a little bit more interesting, though, if you really do want to participate in problem determination and conversion of data generally, then a technology which you'll probably hear a bit about later on is something called compiled converter programs, which is something you can do with Rational Application Developer for System Z. And what that gives you as output is some converter programs written in COBOL, which will do conversions between XML and application data. And because all that's written in, because you've actually got the source code for that to compile up, you could, if you had a reason to do so, inject your own code into that. Just a thought. So yeah, unfortunately the brief answer is that no, there isn't a way to participate programmatically in the troubleshooting.
Okay, thank you very much. Since you mentioned Rational Developer for System Z, we have a question for our Rational Developer. The question is, we're hoping to use your web service tools to build browser-based front-end to many of our legacy 3270 applications. One of the features of our existing applications is field validation upon submission, backed up by a sub-program offering lookup fields for fields that fail validation. For example, if you entered new torque in a city input field for the state of New York, the validation routine would push a lookup screen to users that offered a valid list of cities in New York State. Since it is a subprogram of the original, the selection of valid city immediately becomes part of the submitted response, replacing the invalid entry, and validation can continue. Is this type of integration between the initial submission and reworked response possible in the web services area? We don't want to push the whole screen back out to be reworked and revalidated. Just open a browser window on the user's desk and have them fix an error during the course of validation. The code already exists in CICS, but we would need to maintain a tight level of persistence between each user's initial input and subsequent modifications. I'm going to ask Gary Mazza from our RDZ team to address this.
Thank you, Lee. This is, I think, one of the more detailed questions out of the whole set. I'll try to address a couple of things in here. The reason that I got involved in answering this question is that we have a set of tools within the Rational Developer for System Z that are called a system flow, a service flow modeler. It has a counterpart in the KIX service flow runtime, and as a set of tools, this allows to take 32-70-based screen interactions and turn them into a web services like flows within the KIX web service flow runtime. So, having said that, there is a couple of things here that probably will make you do a little of work even if you use the tools such as a service flow modeler. Typically, the web services interactions are not stateless. So basically, you do have to maintain states between the microflows. And the second part of my answer is related to the front-end programming interface that exists within KIX. And you can use that with the conjunction to the KIX service flow runtime. And in conclusion to in answering this question, I wanted to refer you to the FEPI server adapter processing topics in the KIX service flow runtime user's guide. That one can be found either in CICS Transaction Server 3.1 or 3.2 Information Centers. So that's sort of like a short answer to a relatively detailed question.
Thank you, Gary. So Gary's from our Rational Developers development team. So moving on to the next question, is it possible to get support for SOAP headers? And the clarification was the building of SOAP headers. Paul Cooper, can you address this one?
I'll have a go. Unfortunately, once again, the answer isn't that great. We don't have any ability within the KIX Web Services support to automatically build SOAP headers in the same way that we do for populating the body of SOAP messages. The body is focused on the application, where SOAP headers are usually about qualities of service, so it's things like WS security, WS atomic transactions, and those kind of things. So we do, of course, have various handlers for dealing with WS star specifications, which are available with KIX, but we haven't provided any capability specifically for helping you create your own. Now, having said that, of course, there are technologies out there you can use to make it easier to do that kind of thing, including using the DSML capability within Enterprise COBOL for parsing XML, and using the services of, again, of Rational Developer Systems Z, which has an ability to map COBOL into XML for generic purposes. And I'm quite sure that other vendors have similar capabilities in their products. But yeah, I'm afraid the answer is no, we've not got anything specifically to help you with that at the moment.
I'm going to chime in on this one because writing a SOAP message handler program, a message processing program, would give you the opportunity to create additional SOAP headers. Correct, Paul?
Yes, indeed. So the infrastructure is there so that you can create your own SOAP headers and and process those headers. So all the infrastructure is there, absolutely, that's there. But in terms of actually using the data mapping capability that we provide for populating the body of a SOAP message, we don't have something equivalent to that for populating headers. If you want to write programs which create SOAP headers and consume SOAP headers, then you do so from first principles or using some of the other tools out there.
Okay, thank you, Paul. Question number 11. With web services, RDZ has become a key component for generating production objects. However, the objects generated, such as the WS bind file, are impacted by the responses to the wizard prompts. It is very important that production objects always be created the same, but currently there is no way to record prompt responses and then rerun those responses, so the object generation will always be the same. Please explain what we can expect in the future to enable good practices to be used for the maintaining of production-analyzed web service objects. Gary, since you're from the RDZ team, why don't you answer that one?
Oh, okay, thank you, Lee. Well, actually, there is a way of recording every single choice that is made in the wizard, and it's recorded in a set of XML files that can be used actually to drive a scripted generation process even without invoking the wizard environment. So I will be very happy to provide you a reference to the online information center for Rational Developer for System Z, either version 7.1 or 7.11. There is a chapter in there that talks about a set of tools named Batch Processor. And the Batch Processor is basically a command line environment that allows you to run this scripted generation process with all the choices that you made in the wizard, including everything that you chose for the WS bind and all the related CICS artifacts.
Well, I think that's good news, Gary, and I hope our the submitter of that question picks that up. There's another question for you, though, Gary. Number 12. It's not uncommon in the world of web services to need to consume a WSL that does not include the size parameters, such as min and max length, required by the mainframe. In these cases, the default size is used a lot. Since the WSL is the web service contract, it is preferable not to modify the WSL or the associated XSD. However, currently, RDZ only allows for one default length, which is not sufficient in a lot of cases, thus forcing developers to modify the WSL and or the XSD. This practice invalidates the contract of the service provider and is not the preferable method. A preferred approach may be more defaults or an element-by-element override just to enable the mainframe definitions. Please comment on what we can expect in the future on this issue.
Oh, thank you, Lee. So this is a question I believe that's related to the min and max length of string-like parameters. There is a capability of overriding the default, which is, I believe, currently set at 255 bytes. And that one is in the preferences store, in the preferences dialog for the web services assistant set of tools in Rational Developer for System Z. On the DFH WS2LS page, there is a default share max length, which could be reset and used to override the 255 default. As far as the requirement for individual element by element overrides, it's certainly a valid requirement. We don't have the capability. I would be very happy to learn about what exactly and what the details of that requirement would be. There are some interesting implications of allowing to override individual element by element defaults. Actually, you would probably have to allow overriding the type definitions if you go through the XML schema defining those elements, and that might cause some interesting side effects when you consider that types can be inherited and default lengths could be overridden by inheriting types. But in conclusion, I would be very happy to discuss that further and entertain any potential requests for enhancements.
Okay. Thank you, Gary. As we get to question number 13, there's some background information provided that I'm going to let you read off the chart in the web conference, but let me read the question. How do we set up our RACF key rings to include both self-signed client and server certificates and also the CA, such as Intrust, and site certificates that the region needs? Background is, we are trying to implement client certificates, and when I point the Kix region to a key ring with only the self-signed certificates, I get a 440 SSL error. The self-signed client certificate is added to the key ring as usual, as usage cert off. The self-signed server certificate is in the key ring with the usage personal and default. And then there's some display information. I'm going to ask Mark Pocock to address this question.
Right, well, this isn't specifically web service related. This is just relying on the underlying SSL technology that web services could make use of if you were flowing over TCP/IP. To start with, I would say a good point in creating your own certificates for use with Kix is to use the DFH dollar ring job that Kix supplies. This is a Rex exec which you can run and will create you a suitable set of certificates for use for Kix as a server. It also creates its own certification authority certificate, creates the keyring for you, attaches all those certificates into the keyring, and so you're pretty much ready to go as a server just by running that. The only problem you will have is with various clients, such as browsers and other application servers. If they try to connect you, they may deem your server certificate to be invalid. The reason for that is that they don't have your CA certificate to verify that your server certificate is legitimate. If you are going out to clients that aren't under your direct control, so internet users at browsers typically, then that's when you really need to have a server certificate signed by one of the well-known certification authorities whose CA certificates are already installed in all common browsers. So from the server side, all you needed to have was your server certificate signed by a certificate authority, installed in the keyring, and either set as a default or explicitly specified on the relevant Kix resources, such as TCP/IP service. Things become a little bit more complicated when you move on to Kix acting as a client. So here you will need a certificate signed by somebody, and it could be a self-signed certificate in the client case. And that will need to be added to your key ring so that Kix is able to use it, and it will need to be specified on the appropriate resources or commands that are going to use it, such as your IMAPs for outbound communication. Now that will be sent to the server, and that server will need to be able to verify that your certificate is okay. So he will need the CA certificate that assigns your client certificate. And that's pretty much it. So you just need coordination between the two ends, ensuring that the CA certificates of both the server and the client certificates are available on both sides. The server and client certificates are available in the Kix keyring, and the server certificate is set as the defaults and the client certificate is named on the appropriate resources and commands. The actual commands to get those into the various repositories are going to vary depending on whether you're using RACF on ZOS or whether you're using some trust or key store on a distributed platform.
Okay, thank you, Mark. From the same question set, there's a related question number 14. Is there any place to find SOAP fault messages documented and what the reason action text would be to go along with messages? There's an example of a SOAP fault that was received. Our first attempt at using a self-signed client certificate resulted in the SOAP fault, which you can see there on the screen in our web conference. And the question is, how would a person debug that fault message when nothing is being logged on the mainframe in CICS or the syslog? Fraser, would you like to address that?
Sure. So looking at that fault, I'm going to infer that that was using using the KICS TS 3.1 version of the WS security support, because when we did KICS TS 3.2, we applied some of the WSI profiles conformance to the support, and one thing that will mean is that you don't actually get that detail sent back to the client. Sending detail back to the client in the WS security ports is considered a potential security exposure. So in KICS TS 3.2, that would just tell the client in the fault failed authentication or one of the other six standard WS security faults. As a result, the detail that you see in that fault would end up in the KICS log rather than in the fault message. So as of 3.2, the details are logged to KICS log and exception trace rather than sent in the fault. So that's the first part of that. I did have a chat to the developer of this code today after looking at that as well, and we'll potentially look at making some enhancements to the detail that comes out in the KICS log as well. So the actual answer to that is that you would, once you're on to 3.2 and you can tie up the PI message with the underlying SAS or RACF message that goes with it, you would discover what the problem is there. But we are going to hopefully enhance the actual KICS PI messages to give a better indication of what service has failed. So in that case, for that particular fault, that's occurred because the service IRRSIM00, which is a SAP or RACF service, the user ID that the task is running under, or the KICS job step is running under, is not authorized to access that service.
Okay, thank you, Fraser. And, of course, if the customer had called our Level 2 organization, they would have helped them find that information about the authorization, correct?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Okay, let's move on to question number 15. Is it possible to enable retrieving of the container BFH request after the invoke web service verb has been used by the application program? Paul, I think you're on the spot for this one.
Yeah, okay. Okay, so the invoke web service command is a front end to the request side processing for web services in KICS. So when the application calls invoke web service, under the covers, a whole load of containers get populated with various bits of control information, and then that's sent down the channel, down the pipeline, if you will, until we eventually send the request out to the remote web service. And then when the response comes back from the remote web service, that's the BFH request container, which is one of those kind of intermediate under the covers containers, gets replaced with a BFH response container, which has the response message in it. So normally, no, you can't retrieve the BFH request container after the invoke web service command is completed, because it's already gone by then. That was part of the intermediate information. However, there are quite a few places you can insert code which will be able to take a look at that container and potentially manipulate it or take a snapshot of it or whatever you want to do with it. So in particular, you'd probably be looking at using message handlers within the pipeline. So that would be changing your pipeline configuration file to register a handler that's interested in being driven, and then at runtime that handler would get called and it will have the opportunity to interrogate the channel, have a look at whatever containers it wants to have a look at, potentially change them if it's got a reason to do so, and if that handler program wishes to interact with the application, you know, you could populate containers which the application will then go off and take a look at later. So you could choose to architect that. And indeed, if the concern is that you don't want a handler program to be invoked for every single web service invocation, you just want it for a few of them, then the way to do that would be to configure to configure multiple pipeline resources. So one pipeline for everything else you use, and one specific pipeline set aside for the web service that you wish to have this special handler call for. So that's probably the simplest way to do it, to have a handler program. There are some global user bases again, both as well, but that's a little bit more complicated. But again, if you search through the information center, you can find out all about that. We put out an APAR a few months ago, which added some extra glues in there. So there you go.
Okay, thank you, Paul. Question number 16 asks, we are on CICS TS version 2.2 with the SOAP feature installed. We're scheduled to install CICS TS version 3.2 in the first quarter of 2009. All of the CICS web services that I have written are service providers. The client applications are .NET. The CICS web services parse the input XML message and generate the output XML message. We do not use WSDL. The .NET client sends a SOAP message without using a WSDL to the Kix web service. So our question is, by changing the BTS input and output container names to the new KixTS version 3.2 container names for XML input and output, would our current web services run without a WSDL and without the SOAP feature being installed in KixTS version 3.2? And related to that, what is the migration path for web services written using the Kix SOAP feature without rewriting all of our current web services? Fraser, since you were involved with the SOAP feature, would you like to answer that one?
Yeah, sure. So the short answer is, yes, all that's possible. The KixTS 3.1 and 3.2 info centers contain a topic on exactly this process. It's slightly more complicated than just changing the input and output container names. There's a few more BTS things that have to be stripped out of that program, in particular the way the thing returns, because today it's probably doing an end activity type return. So the info center lists the programmatic changes that need to be made in the individual application handlers, and also how to configure the KixTS version 3 pipeline to not use our supplied web services support that runs off bind files and web service resources, but target your custom program that you were already using in the feature in KixTS version 2. So it's all documented, all supported, and there's a set of standard steps in the info center to go through to achieve that. And as a final note on that, I have seen several customers that have done exactly that. So that's the simple migration, where you just use your existing program. In KixTS version 3.2, there's an additional option on the web service that you can generate a bind file which provides pass-through of the XML, which could also target that program. And this allows you to combine the benefits of scanned web services and system management of web services and the DPL option that it's got without actually exploiting any of the data mapping capability. So that provides straight pass-through to a targeted application program. But that's only available in KixTS 3.2.
Thank you, Fraser. Question number 17 asks about the resource definition. Seems like there is a limitation to the web service name of 8 characters if we choose to predefine URI maps and web services. The reason for this approach is to attach a different user ID with the URI map in test and in production so that we don't have to generate 2 WS bind files using RDZ. Do you always recommend pipeline scans? Your thoughts? Fraser, we're going to ask you to tackle that one too.
All right. Yes, there is a limitation of 8 characters if you statically define the web service resources. And that's simply because Kix as a whole has an 8 character resource name limit due to the structure of the CSD. Do we recommend one approach over the other? No, I think this is one where there are good reasons in certain circumstances to use one over the other. Now, in terms of generating 2 bind files using RDZ, this is a recognized issue, and I think it was Dennis, in fact, did a support pack that allows you to modify those values in a bind file without actually going through the whole regeneration process. So the data mapping is left intact, and just those operational values that are used to generate the URI map are updated, and it's support pack CS04, I think. So you can use that to avoid having to do the whole regeneration. So if you're looking for that sort of capability, perhaps that combined with pipeline scan would be satisfactory.
This is Gary Mazza. I just wanted to add to what Fraser just said, that there will be a functionality coming in one of the soon-coming versions of RDZ that allows you to actually edit the WS bind file and modify the URI map and the user ID.
Okay, thank you, guys. That gives the customer several options to to pursue. Question number 18, and the last of the questions that was submitted in advance, says, I have a WSDL document that is rejected by DFH WS to LS. What can I do? Paul, how about answering that one?
Sure. Okay, so the first question has to be for what reason it's been rejected, because there is quite a lot of different reasons. So the first thing that we would always recommend is to start off by ensuring that the WSDL document you've got is well-formed and is valid. And there's several ways you can do that. One technique that we use quite a lot internally is to load that document up in Eclipse. Eclipse is a development environment, but one of the nice features it has in it is the ability to validate WSDL documents. It'll validate it according to the WSDL specification, but it also validates it according to a set of rules called the WSI Basic Profile. And what the Basic Profile is it's a set of extra rules on top of the underlying specifications which define guidelines for ensuring interoperable web services. So the basic WSDL and SOAP specifications have all sorts of things that they define which you can do, but tend to lead to problems, because either they're under-specified or because they're not relevant in particular circumstances or what have you. Right, so the WSI Basic Profile, it comes along and says, you know, if interoperability is important, and it usually is with web services, then limit yourself to using WSDL documents of this particular form or with those characteristics. And so Eclipse is very nice. It's got a validator built in which you can use. You can just right-click on a WSDL document and it will tell you whether that is valid or not. And if it isn't, it will tell you exactly what's wrong with it. So it's a great idea to do that before invoking WS2LS. DHWS2LS does, of course, do some validation itself, and it looks for certain types of problems, and it does issue messages. In some cases, those messages are very specific, and in other cases, it's just propagating messages which have been issued by underlying components which we don't directly control. So there's various different packages that we use within WS2LS which can themselves spot problems. So yeah, the first thing, make sure you've got valid WSDL. If you don't have valid WSDL, then everything after that becomes a little bit uncertain. If you do have a valid WSDL document, the next thing would be to make sure you're using the most recent mapping level that's available. The mapping level is the version of the programmatic interface that's shared between KIX and between the application. So it's the knowledge of what goes where within the COM area and what conversions to apply. Now, at each of the various different mapping levels, we've added new capabilities, and in many cases, that involves support for constructs within WSDL and within the XML schema language that weren't previously supported. So, originally, in TF 3.1, we just had a fairly basic level of capabilities, but we put out various APARs over time which have enhanced that. We have mapping levels 1.1 and 1.2, which between them added a lot of new capabilities. Now for TF 3.2, we've already put out mapping level 2.1, which has enhanced the support for WSDL in quite a few different directions. Imminently, there'll be another APAR going out for mapping level 2.2, which again will broaden the range of constructs that are supported. So, use the most recent mapping level that's available to you. If you're still having problems, if there's still something in the WSDL which kicks for whatever reason, can't or doesn't support, and it's not an option to change the WSDL, then at that point we've got to fall back on fairly generic options. One thing that you can do at TF 3.2 is to use the XML-only capability, which Fraser mentioned a moment ago. This is a way of opting out of the KIX supplied data conversions. So you could choose to write an application which handles all of its XML parsing and serialization manually. It's a whole lot of effort, but of course by doing that yourself, you have full control over what happens, so you're no longer restricted by any limitations within KIX. Another possibility is to make use of the XSD any construct. This is a special construct which allows arbitrary XML content to appear at particular points within a SOAP message. And that's something that we brought out support for in mapping level 2.1. So what you could do there is, if a very particular part of the XML schema or WSDL document is known to be causing problems, you could effectively comment it out, but replace it with an any tag. And what that will mean is that KIX won't attempt to try and do any conversions on that subsection of the XML, when in fact, pass it through to the application just as a chunk of XML. So the application nicely. So there's very different options there. It's difficult to know what the right answer is because it really does depend on the nature of the problem. But we have significantly reduced the scope of unsupported constructs in Woodstock. So moving up to TF 3.2 and the latest mapping level available in most cases is the right answer. And that's pretty much all I have to say.
Okay, thank you very much. At this point, I'm going to turn the call back to Elijah, and Elijah's going to solicit your questions.
Thank you, Lee. We would like to thank everyone for submitting these questions to our panel today prior to today's open mic. Also, to everyone asking a question, please limit introductions to first and last name. We will now go to our live questions. So, Heather, I'd like to turn the call over to you, opening lines for questions.
And we'll take our first question from Mike Giaquinto with Wells Fargo.
Hi, good morning. I have a question about the XML parsing and ZAP engine. Will CICS be able to make use of that? One of our barriers to people wanting to use XML and SOAP is the number of elements that are being parsed. So running them on a ZAP engine would help. I know that new COBOL will support running XML parsing on the ZAP engine. How will that support work with CICS SOAP?
Okay, I'll take that. This is Fraser. Let's see. First thing to say is that, as of the statement of direction a while back, offload to ZAP or ZIP of XML parsing is strategic across the board on Z. So if it's not there yet, you could probably infer from that it's something we're very seriously thinking about. In terms of specifics of what's available today, yes, XML system services as a parsing technology, which is a feature of VOS, will offload to ZAP or ZIP. As of RDZ 7. As of the latest level of COBOL, the enterprise COBOL, that parser can be configured to exploit the XML system services. And I'm sure we'll see more things like that. So if you're using the parse verb in COBOL in KIX, that will actually offload, even though KIX itself doesn't do any offload currently to ZAP. I'm sure we'll see a continued direction for more XML parsing being targeted to the ZAP and ZIP offload engines.
And we'll hear next from Milesh Bagheer with Fidelity Investment.
Thank you. I have a couple of questions in terms of debugging. And at debug time, how do we enable TCP monitor to see the SOAP to be sent on the wire or received from the wire? Especially, I'm right now working on a proof of concept for some of our strategic solutions in the direction of CICS web services. And I'm coming across a bunch of errors while invoking external distributed web services. One of the instances is sending me a handler error within handler, but when I try to handle the handler error, the inspection of DFH error container and DFH response container has junk information such as .r and the name of the container. So it's not easy for me to conclude whether the SOAP envelope was sent on the wire or is it the response coming back from the web service which is invalid. That was one incident. Second question I had was, does the CICS web service runtime uses WSBind file to infer the schema structure while serializing and deserializing the SOAP envelope from to and from the copybook to SOAP schema, SOAP XML, and SOAP XML to the copybook? The other question I had was, is there any option to allow web services to eliminate white spaces around in the values within the tags?
Okay, I'm going to repeat these questions, and I think I've written them down. I'm going to break them up and ask them separately. Your first question had to do with debugging using the TCP monitor to monitor the connection. Dennis, would you like to answer that one?
Sure. There is a very nice handy feature. It's actually part of Rational Application Developer, and is therefore also part of Rational Developer for System Z, and it is called the TCP/IP Monitor Server. It's actually been in there for several years. And what you can do is you can essentially see what has been sent on the line. So imagine a client, imagine your CICS server. You configure the TCP/IP monitor server to sit between the two. So the client, instead of directing a request directly to CICS, directs it to the TCP/IP monitor server, which then forwards it on to CICS. And as information passes through the TCP/IP monitor server, there will be a view that pops up that will actually show exactly what was sent in either directions. And not only can you see the SOAP message, you can also see the HTTP headers.
Dennis, my question is exactly for a situation exactly opposite to this. I'm filing a CICS web service request from CICS, and I want an ability to enable TCP monitoring on CICS end to see the traffic going in and out of CICS in the requester mode.
Well, a couple things strike me, and then I'll let other people jump in. But you can still use the TCP/IP monitor server. It's a standalone application, so the request can actually come from anywhere and go to anywhere. But additionally, if you'd like to see the request that went out, one thing that comes to mind is that you could write a message handler, and that message handler inside of CICS, you could actually essentially dump the contents of that outbound message. And there is an example in one of the red books, and it is called Sniffer.
I'm using that, Dennis, right now. I use the Sniffer code, and I have the handler. I'm able to inspect the SOAP envelope, but once the handler code is executed, in the next step, I'm expecting a response coming back from the distributed service. And in that case, the DFH function is returning handler error to me. And in the handler, while handling the handler error condition, I try to inspect the DFH error container and DFH response container. And none of them have a SOAP envelope, which is either coming from the distributed web service or something which has been generated within CICS domain, which failed before posting the SOAP envelope to the distributor.
Mm-hmm.
So I could comment on the DFH error container issue. What's likely happened here is there's some sort of transport error that's happened. So the first thing to say is I hope there's some messages in the KIX log. If you really want to see what was sent on the transport, then turning on, if you're using HTTP, WB, and SO level 2 tracing will give you a much clearer idea of what's happening there.
Nope.
And the DFH error container is never intended to actually have XML in it, which is probably why you're not seeing what you're expecting. It's actually a copybook-like language structure with various values filled in to try and tell you what the error was. And there is a copybook called DFHPIUC, followed by a language letter, in the DFH sub installation directory, which has details of the layout and the constants that get set in there. So that's a container for programmatic inspection, but it won't have XML in it. You have to look at the language structure overlay and then write code that interprets it if that's what you want to do.
Okay,
thank you. And one of the things that I would point out is that it is possible to use the TCP/IP monitor of RDZ for outbound requests. You just need to change the endpoint location in your web service definition to point to the TCP/IP monitor server and then have it relay that request to the remote system. I believe that at the current levels of KIX Transaction Server 3.2, one can provide a URI map override for that outbound destination. I'm not sure. I'd have to do a little more research on that one. Okay, so now your next question had to do with the WS bind file and how it's used to correlate the mapping of the XML data into the COM area or the container structures. Paul Cooper said he can help you with that one.
Sorry, I didn't entirely catch the question. Can I just clarify what's being asked?
So, Paul, would you like me to repeat the question?
If you could, please, yes.
Yes. Thank you, Paul. My curiosity is the mapping information what's created in the WSPI file, is that used at runtime by CSS?
The actual mapping information? Well, yes, okay. So there's a whole load of mapping information that's stored within the WSPI file.
Correct.
It's used interpretively at runtime, so yes. There's various different types of information in there. Some of it is about deployment, things like the URI to expose the web service on, the program name of the web service, of the application that implements the web service, those kind of things are in there. There's also a lot of information about how to actually translate the application data structures into XML and vice versa. And all that information is stored as metadata within the WSBI file. So that is used at runtime. And then, of course, we have algorithms in the runtime which know how to interpret that metadata together with either the XML, which has arrived on the wire, or the application data, which is coming from a COM area or similar, and convert from one format to the other. So all that's in there. And then the mapping level specifies the version of the algorithms to use, if you like. So every time we enhance the mapping to do something that we didn't support before, we add a new mapping level as a way of providing version control. So KIX will know if a bind file contains instructions that it can't support because the mapping level is too high for it to switch to cope with. Does that answer the question?
Honestly, not completely, because the couple of things I wanted to confirm was, what if the schema on the producer end is having a repetitive structure?
A repeating structure, a recurring structure.
Okay, and for the sake of, for the heck of it, let's say if I've taken the copy of that schema and tampered that to remove the repetitive structure because I want to avoid the container that's going.
Okay.
So as a result of that, the visual and the schema, what I have used in creating WSBind file, does not have any repetitive structure of it. Now, as a result of that, then I get a response from the producer which contains repetitive structure. Is the CICS web service going to fail, is going to abandon while mapping that XML into the copybook, what I have created based on the tampered schema?
Okay. Nilesh?
Yes.
This is Nilesh, right?
Yes, please.
Yes. Let us get back to you on the rest of your questions. We want to make sure that everybody who dialed in got an opportunity to ask a question.
Okay.
And I have your contact information, and we will get back to you.
All right.
Operator, do we have other questions?
We do. We'll hear next from John Fausten with IBM.
Thank you.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Well, hi, Lee. John. This is a very simple question. I feel almost ashamed to ask it after all the technical questions. But anyway, it's a very simple question. Do IBM have any recommendation for HFS directory structure for the three artifact areas, the config, the shelf, and the WSDIR? Because when I look at the red books and the documentation, it seems to be quite a multiplicity of what various people have suggested.
Okay. I'm going to repeat the question in case you were too faint for some others on the call. John wants to know what recommendations IBM might make in terms of the Unix file system structures to hold the various artifacts that are used by CICS, the configuration files, the WSBind files, and the WSDL. Is there someone from Hursley who would like to chime in on this? Fraser.
Right. The short answer is no, we don't have a single recommendation for how to structure them, mainly because every customer environment you come across often has different rules for how HFS or ZFS has to be partitioned. So we haven't mandated or even, I think, the best practice necessarily, ordering of how you partition the ZFS or HFS structure.
The only thing that we dictate, of course, is the set of permissions that CICS needs in order to access those files.
Yeah, so for individual directories or files, CICS needs certain permissions on them, but where you put them in a hierarchy of directories is not it's not necessarily relevant, or not something we mandate.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Do we have other questions?
Okay, and we'll hear from Earl Rogers with Bank of America.
Hi. This is somewhat alluding to something that Lee mentioned a couple minutes ago. When CACS is consuming a web service, using Invoke web service, other than specifying the location on the API command, is there a way to change the endpoint in a resource definition or any other suggestions on how we might do that? That normally it will just pick up what's ever in the bind file.
Okay. Paul Cooper says he's going to answer this after I repeat the question. So the question is, given that I have a endpoint specified in my WSBind file that gets picked up and inserted into the web service definition in my CICS region when I do the scan of the pipeline, is there any way that I can change that endpoint definition other than overriding it in my application program? Paul?
Okay. So, yes, you can have the endpoint encoded within the WSBind file, but that is indeed static. And we did mention earlier the support pack, which will allow you to change that, but again, you know, that's not dynamically at runtime. So the other alternative is to specify the URI on the Invoke Web Service command, and indeed, changing your application program to change the URI would be quite a bit of a hassle. So one thing that you can use, it has issues as well, but it's something that I have seen folks use quite successfully, is to define a URI map resource, which has a name, you know, a well-known name, and specifies the URI of the remote service. Then once you use the execkicks inquire URI map command, it's an API command, but use that programmatically from within either the application or from a trusted module that the application links to, and have the URI to use as you come back from the inquire URI map command, and then plug that into the Invoke Web Service.
I mean, the alternative there, if you don't want to have anything in the application layer, would be to do a similar processing in a message handler in the pipeline, which instead of updating the URI in the Invoke Web Service, just updates the URI in the DFHWS URI container, which will have a similar effect by the time you get to the end and go out on the transport. So you could write a handler that queries a URI map which is named in a container on the channel, and then query the URI map and change the URI container. There is a tech doc available which details the approach Paul just described. And, I mean, this is a requirement or a capability we get questions about quite often. So you might imagine it's one that we're thinking about other ways to solve in the future.
Okay, do we have other questions?
It appears we have no further questions at this time.
Okay, thank you. Elijah?
All right, thank you, Heather. We would like to summarize our call today, but I would like to turn the presentation over to Fraser for a brief summary.
So we've discussed the basics of KIX Web Services, and then we have been through a number of questions, many of which have gone into some of the really gory details, but I think that's a good thing to see. It means people out there are really using this stuff and really getting to grips with some of the nitty gritty. So I've been very pleased with the level of detail and quality of the questions.
And then at this time, we'll conclude the presentation. We hope that we were very helpful to you today in answering your questions, and hope this call has been very valuable to you. We appreciate your participation. Hope you will join us for future open mics, which will be announced on the Web Series Support Technical Exchange site. Remember, a replay of today's presentation and question and answer session will also be available on the site in the next day or two. Thanks very much for joining us today, and thank you to the panel for speaking with us today.